Okay, good evening. So tonight we're going to try and answer the question, why study Talmud? And the answer is, in one word, depth. We have Sturgeon's Law, which is 90% of everything is crap. And I find that in general to be true in life, that most books, films, art, people are really not worth your time. But when you find someone that's good, something that's good, you keep it, you hold on to it. And we all have a sense that the Torah is a deep and profound thing, but when we read it, it seems dry or anachronistic or insensitive. And I want to suggest that there is an approach to read Talmud, Torah/Talmud, in a deeper way. And it is the Steve theory of depth. That in general, I find that there are three levels of meaning. Not all the time, there's almost always two levels of meaning, but sometimes there's a third. And I think depth you get from drilling down. So the three levels are basically the plain meaning, which is what's the meaning of the words themselves. The second level is the human meaning, which is trying to put yourself in the shoes of each person that's having a dispute, and seeing where they come from, what's their worldview, what are their assumptions. And I think it's often the case we'll find that the two sides are really arguing different things. And of course, the Talmud rarely gives us the answer. It almost always gives us the practices, and we have to kind of figure out what's going on behind that. And then there's a third meaning, which I said is not always there, but is, I think, mostly there, which is, why is this topic important in the first place? Is there something in common that undergirds all of this? And I call this also the God meaning, which is basically, what does God want of us? So to give very quickly two secular examples, political examples, which of course we never discuss politics here. So example one is abortion, right? And the top simple level is, can you terminate a pregnancy? Then you go down to the second level and you have the argument. So on one side you have the argument that a woman has a right to determine what happens to her own flesh, her own body. The other side will say, you're taking a human life. What's undergirding all of that? That's the level two meaning. And those two things are not necessarily in contradistinction to each other. Underneath, I think, the whole discussion is really the argument about personhood, about what is life, and it's being reflected in different ways. Okay, quick example number two is gun control, right? On the top level, the question is, can you own a gun? Now, again, one side will say, in America, the Constitution says it's a right. The other side will argue, guns are dangerous. Again, not really the same arguments on each side. And I think, once again, there's an underlying level three of freedom is really the issue. Do you have a right to safety? Do you have a right to protection under the American system? That's kind of the underlying thing. Okay, so all that being said, what I want to do tonight is give four examples from the Talmud where they seem kind of arguments that are not very important or kind of silly, and have us try and delve into them and see what's really going on underneath. So the first example in the handout is from the book of Leviticus, and it's the Parshat Tzav. It starts with the laws of lighting menorahs and making showbread, which we will talk much about later. And then there's an incident that is related whereby a man from the tribe of Dan says God's name, and he is taken into custody until God orders that he be taken out and stoned. So, stoning. So stoning is a biblical punishment, and it's not what you think it is. The way you stone someone in the Bible was, you had the two witnesses, right? All crimes must have two legal witnesses. And the way it works is you take the victim. What do you call that? The defendant? Okay, whatever. Defendant. The criminal. You take him to the top of a two-story building, and witness number one pushes him off. If he does not die, witness number two comes along and drops a huge rock on him. And if he still doesn't die, then people come and pelt them with stones, like in a Monty Python movie. So that's how stoning took place in ancient times. Okay, so that is the text from Leviticus. We take the blasphemer outside the camp, and all who are within hearing lay their hands upon his head, and the whole community will stone him. So the Mishnah now is commenting on this. And they're giving you the practice. When he is about 4 cubits distance from the place of stoning, 4 cubits, 6 feet, he is stripped of his clothing. A man is covered in front, and a woman in both in front and behind, according to Rabbi Yehuda. But the sages say, a man is to be stoned naked, and a woman is not to be stoned naked. So, at the level one issue, we think we all understand this here, you can ask certain questions. Now, first of all, this question is in the Talmud. And the Talmud was written, we know, 100 to 500 years after the destruction of the first temple. So, was there a Sanhedrin, the court, operating at the time this was written? No. It was long in the past. Which leads us to another question, right? Was this punishment ever really enacted? Talmud itself says, no, this never happened. Another question, how did cultures deal with the death penalty at this time? Now, as bizarre as this sounds to us, earlier forms of capital punishment were designed to be slow, painful, and tortuous. In some ancient cultures, lawbreakers were put to death by stoning, crucifixion, burned at the stake. So what's really going on here with the Mishnah? And I will argue that it is the desire to take this Torah commandment and make it into a concrete, practical thing. And why did they want to do that? Because they wanted to have a system of law, a regulation. And that is what the Mishnah is doing here. Okay? By the way, feel free to challenge me at any time.
Well, the one thing that occurs to me, because you said it was not done at any time, but this goes back to Leviticus. So, you know, the fact that it's in Leviticus, mm-hmm. I mean, might not have been done at the time of the writing of the Talmud, but prior to the writing of the Talmud, I would guess it's in there and probably was done.
not necessarily. I mean, I did a whole thing about the rebellious son, where you take him out to the court.
An example.
And again, the Talmud says, on one hand, never happened and never will. Then you have Rabbi Yonatan who says, I sat on his grave and laughed. So I don't know the answer to that, Stanley, in a word, if that ever happened. But so I wanted to get past this of, you know, what's it doing here? Now we go to the level two, where we look at what the dispute's about, and we see what point they're arguing and why. So the dispute here is between the rabbis and the sages. So Rabbi Judah says, we cover a man in the front and a woman in the front and behind. In other words, each sex has different clothing requirements. The sages say, no, there are opposite requirements here. Okay, so what is this whole business about the clothing? Why are they stripped? Want to take a guess?
Embarrass them.
Yeah, humiliate them.
Okay, that's a good answer, which we'll get to in a second. I would say that on the first level, it just makes the execution more efficient. Because if you're all covered up with clothing and you get thrown rocks at, it might not hurt as much. But now let's go down and say, what is behind this argument? So there are two things, and one of them is, you're right, it's about the dignity of a naked person. And there's a presumption built in here that women suffer more from being naked than men do. And perhaps nakedness or degradation of nakedness is really a kind of pain that is inflicted on the criminal. So that's one thing. The other thing I mentioned is pain, right? The more covered up you are, the more dignity you have, but theoretically, it's going to be a worse punishment for you, so there's going to be more physical pain.
But the clothing would make less pain.
No, but it'll take longer.
No, it'll take longer. And
got it. Would, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think these people are wearing all that much clothing then. I mean, they're living in a hot climate. It's not as if they were living in freezing climate where they had layers and furs and...
This is true. This is true, but this actually goes back to the previous point of, is this a realistic thing in the first place? So, now we get down to level three, which is, I think, the subtext here is really, you go back to what Stanley said, should we be executing people in the first place? Is this something we want to do? Right? And the Talmud, in the section after the Mishnah, goes on to discuss, I want to tell you these various things. So they talk about what areas of the man and the woman should be covered, front or back. Now, the text says, when he is about 4 cubits from the place of stoning. So the question the rabbis ask is, does this come to exclude women? And their answer is no. It comes to say that they should be dressed differently. There's a whole long session, as always, when women are around, there's a worry about arousing sexual thoughts in men. Does execution imply humiliation? Physical comfort of wearing clothes versus the degradation of not having it. So what is this debate really about? And here I think is an example of what begins as a technical debate over the procedures of an imaginary system of capital punishment turns into a discussion about the relative weights of physical versus psychological pain, and I think of death penalty in general. Now, later halachists came along, and they used this Mishnah to discuss, and this is a really an interesting takeoff, the best use of community funds that are set aside for poverty relief. So when you go into a neighborhood where people are poor, what's your priority? Do you clothe them or do you feed them? Because you don't have unlimited resources. And the truth is, if you think about it, we have the exact same debates in our society today about welfare policy, about medical ethics, and about battlefield policies. So, to summarize the whole example, I think it's the technical details of halakha are really a layer over the core question about issues of human nature. And that's where we get it from. Okay? On to number two, then. So, the case of number two is the case where you have a murder victim found outside of a town, and we don't know who the killer is. So the elders of the town are called in to claim responsibility, and they assemble in a wadi, a dry riverbed. They ceremonially break a calf's neck and wash their hands in water as a symbolic gesture of atonement. Now, again, you're going to see a lot of comparisons of what we've been doing. Practically, you could really only do this if the body was exactly equidistant between two towns, right? And how could they have measured that in those days? And, by the way, nowhere does it say how you measure the distance. Do you measure from the farthest point of the city wall, from the town center, from the synagogue, whatever? So, right off the bat, again, it's problematic. So let's look at the quote from Deuteronomy. So, and there's a kind of an odd translation here. So if in the land, which is written Ba'adama, that the Lord your God is assigning you to possess, someone slain is found lying in the open. Now it doesn't literally say in the open, it says Ba'sadeh, in the field. The identity of the slayer not being known, your elders and magistrates shall go out and measure the distances from the corpse to the nearby towns. So once again, I want to say the case of is, you know, we look back, is this practical? Did people really do this? You know, there was no legal system again in effect at the time this was really written. So once again, I think as in the last case, we already start to qualify it. So we go to the Mishnah Torah, which is now, you want to buy dates, you know, it's 2,200 years after this text was written. And this is Maimonides coming along, and you'll see what he's already trying to do is further restrict the practice of this law. So Deuteronomy states, when a corpse is found, now the term for corpse is halal here, which is not the normal term for a dead people, would be mate. So halal is a special word, and it means a person slain with a sword and not strangled to death, nor a person in his death throes. These are not implied by the term halal. So right away, he's trying to limit the scope where the text says, you found someone slain. Here he's saying, no, it's got to be someone who is slain with a sword. Just that specific. Further goes on to say, the fact that the text says, in the earth, basadeh, means, therefore, not buried in a mound. Fallen, and I don't even know where the word fallen came in here, but fallen means not hanged. In the field, basadeh, means not in the water. And it is not known who killed him. Thus, if we do know who killed him, we don't have to go through with this whole process. So,
does the person have to be Jewish if it's dead?
I would assume the answer is yes, but I do not know for a fact.
So I'm just wondering what they would do with a non-Jewish person.
Toss him in the wadi.
I don't know. And the issue here isn't the dead person. The issue here is determining culpability. Yeah.
Right, so if nobody takes responsibility...
Right, so they're coming,
this
is a formula
for
how they're
going to
dispose
of
the body, how they're going to assign responsibility.
They're also culpable for burying the person.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
And any care for widows and orphans and so on. So that's where the culpability comes in, not necessarily for the murder itself, but it was murdered
They want to recognize the murder and the fallen person.
Because you're not allowed to leave a person in the field, for the day.
And I'll go further with that. This whole act, I think, is a symbol of expiation that a murder could take place in their town or outside their town. It should have been a safe zone.
Just to rid them of the stigma of the murder.
Something went wrong that there should be a murderer near their town.
They have to atone for it.
Yes, exactly. Interestingly, the Mishnah here goes on to comment that when the murderers multiplied, they stopped doing this practice. So once again, it's a formal thing here, but I don't know what that says about crime control in those days, but...
It helps the kids.
But the point is this procedure, once again, was no longer in use already after the Second Temple. Okay, so now we get to the silly part, the Mishnah here. So the question is asked, from what part of the body do they measure? Rabbi Eliezer says, from the navel. Rabbi Akiva says, from the nose. Rabbi Eliezer ben Jacob says, from the place where he was made a slain person, in other words, the cause of his death, which we know now is from the neck.
Well,
so there's three things going on here.
There's nothing that says from the neck until we get to Sota.
Well, you mean in the text itself?
Yeah.
I don't know why I want to say this. I mean, again, Maimonides seems to qualify it, but it did seem to indicate that it was someone found strangled.
No, not strangled.
No, Maimonides says that, but I think in the Torah text, some I have in my head, I may be wrong, that it was a strangled person.
Right, because Maimonides is saying halal.
It means not strangled. It's just
someone who's slain with a sword or stabbed and not strangled to death.
Yeah, no, I agree. He's turning it around, but nevertheless, so I'm not sure what the neck here means, other than we have this argument. So this, again, is the thing that just seems really silly to us today. Like, what kind of, this is an angel dancing on the head of a pin argument. So what could that possibly mean? So the Gemara now asks that question. What are they disagreeing about? So one sage holds, this would be Rabbi Akiva, life is primarily in the nose. And one sage holds, Rabbi Eliezer, life is primarily in the navel. So now it begins to make a little more sense.
It does?
Yes, it does. Because what are they talking about? They're talking about the essence of a person. So the Yerushalmi now comes along and says, Rabbi Eliezer says, from his navel, he means the place where the fetus was recreated. And Rabbi Akiva says, from his nostrils, that is the place where the face is recognized.
Like, what does that have to do with the nearby towns and the corn?
Nothing. Exactly. That's the point. They've shifted gears now. They're talking about, how do we measure the essence of a person? Is a person fundamentally a physical being, the navel, or fundamentally a spiritual being, the breath? And what is this essence of a human being? Is it innate, or is it based on recognition? You know, the tree falls in a forest and no one's there to see it. So it seems that the level three here, that the ceremony of the calf is really designed to draw attention to the uniqueness of human life. And after this point in the Talmud, it goes on to talk about formation of embryos and when the rabbis think the beginning of life is. So yeah, see, again, this is the subversion thing where it goes into another place.
I presume the sections of the Mishnah that aren't printed here are... tells us it goes back to this verse?
Yeah. Yeah, they're related. Is that where the Mishnah comes from? Yeah, it's all Mishnah and Sota. So that's where it comes from.
So
okay.
Sota's all on Deuteronomy?
Pardon?
No,
Sota's about the suspected wife.
Right.
But you know the Talmud, everything is in everything. Okay, this next one I will admit is my favorite for the evening because it really, the sleight of hand you just saw is really present here in a very different way. So this is about the showbread, which I mentioned earlier, which is something I don't know that anyone ever thinks about when they look back on the Torah and what is it. So there's a commandment in Leviticus, it's, you know, about the temple. You shall take choice flour and bake of it 12 loaves, 2/10 of a measure, that's an ephah, for each loaf. Place them on a pure table before the Lord in 2 rows, 6 to a row. With each row you shall place pure frankincense, which is a token offering for the bread, as an offering by fire to the Lord. He shall arrange them before the Lord regularly every Sabbath day. It is a commitment for all time, chak olam, on the part of the Israelites. They shall belong to Aaron and his sons, who shall eat them in the sacred precinct. For they are as his most holy things from the Lord's offering by fire, a dew for all time. That's a chak olam, sorry about that. An eternal law, an everlasting law, a perpetual obligation. Okay. Now, we go on further into Exodus about this bread. And on the table you shall set the bread of display, the show bread, to be before me, always, the Hebrew, tamid, always. And this is going to be the key word about what's going on here. So, first, we have the Mishnah, and you probably don't even realize what's the issue going on right here. And I will tell you the issue is about the word always. So once again, we get this nice description of how they actually did this, none of which, of course, is in the Torah. There were two tables inside the sanctuary at the entrance of the table, one of marble, one of gold. On the table of marble, they laid the showbread when it was brought in, and on the table of gold, they laid the showbread when it was brought out. Since we raise the status of what is holy and we don't lower it down. You remember there's a rule saying you can only increase in holiness. Mm-hmm. So on Hanukkah, for example, the reason we add a candle each night is so we are holier every night rather than take one away the Shammai way. So that's what they're saying here. If we put it originally on marble, we wind up on gold, so we're increasing holiness. Within the sanctuary, there was a table of gold on which the showbread lay continually. 4 priests enter, 2 carrying 2 rows in their hands, and 2 carrying 2 dishes of frankincense in their hand. And 4 went before them, 2 to take away, and 2 to take away the dishes of frankincense. So they were doing like a literally a swap out. Those who brought them in stood at the north side facing south. Those who took them away stood on the south side facing north. They withdrew the old, and the others laid down the new, the handbreadth of one being the side of the handbreadth of the other, as it is said, before me continually. And that's the verse from Exodus, Lifnei, Lechem Panim, Lifnei Tamid, before me always. Okay, so that's the description, right? You get the thing that they have the bread here, and because they want to keep that commandment of always, continually, they literally would do a rolling swap. So there would always be the bread on the table. But along comes Rabbi Yossi and says, even if the first took away the old and the others laid the new one down later, not instantaneously, that still fulfills the requirement of continually. So do you see the dispute here? It's a rapid exchange versus within a reasonable period of time. How do we define what continually means? And on the next page, there's your audiovisual aid, and you can see them in their clothes, carrying in the showbread. I didn't read this, but I didn't know this till I looked it up, but apparently it was like a way they baked the showbread, and it was shaped like a U with an opening. And I don't know what that means or how they did it, but this is where I always throw to Stu, these are topics for you. Investigation of the showbread.
I'd never heard that before.
Okay. So, the Mishnah says Tamid means there must always be 12 loaves of bread on the table literally every moment of the day. Rabbi Yossi is a little looser. As long as the bread is replaced on the same day, that counts as always. Now we go to the Babli, and here's where you're going to see the gymnastics. Rabbi Ami says, from Rabbi Yossi's statement, we may learn that even if a person learned only one chapter the morning and one chapter the evening, he has fulfilled the mitzvah of this Torah scroll should not depart from your mouth, which is in the book of Joshua, interestingly. So it can't technically be a Torah mitzvah. But notice what he's doing. He has now gone to Rabbi Yossi's opinion, and let's put it this way. He's now done jujitsu. He's changed a physical requirement, bread should be continuous, into a theological issue. Namely, how can we be in the presence of God all the time? Right? So there's the sleight of hand. It's like the bread. He swapped out the real bread for the theoretical bread. And what Rabbi Ami is saying is we go by Rabbi Yossi, right? We have a requirement to always be absorbed with Torah.
Right.
But you don't have to do that all day long. You do a chapter in the morning and a chapter in the evening, and that's good.
Because that's also how you can have commerce and just an economic situation. You know, if we're going to barter for, you know, goods and services, it can't always be quoting verses from Torah to sell a pound of butter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that allows you to speak of other things.
Yes, but you're putting the cart before the horse in effect. Right? You're giving a practical reason. You're like the Mishnah. Well, it's too hard to do this because we need to engage in commerce so we can live.
Yeah.
But they're not doing that, right? They're talking about a theological point.
How are we
occupied with God all day long? Okay, so let's go on with this. Let's go on with this. But just again, notice here that the priests and the bread are gone, right? Now we have a reference point for one of life, an observant person's most important question, right? How do I go around as a religious person all day long? How do I go around thinking about God or praying or learning? So we already have one answer. Rabbi Yochanan says in the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, even if a person only recited the Shema in the morning and in the evening, he has fulfilled this requirement of. So now it's kind of going back even a little more. What does it mean to say Torah shall not depart from your mouth? And I can't remember the Hebrew, but we all know it. Rabbi Ami is taking it as a learning thing. You need to learn. Rabbi Yochanan has swapped in now. It's about praying. Now, saying the Shema counts as study. That's a fundamental thing. That's why we recite the Shema, we don't pray the Shema.
Right, and it's also you reciting Torah.
Right. So now they go off on even on more of a tangent. But it is prohibited to state this matter in the presence of ignoramuses, Amei Haaretz. And Rava says, it is a mitzvah to state this matter in the presence of ignoramuses. So why are they concerned about you saying this in the presence of unlearned people? And, excuse me. So the rabbis are worried now, because if you say this in the presence of ignoramuses, they're going to get the impression that this is all you need to do to study, to be in God's presence. I'll leave it at that way.
Can I ask about the Hebrew Amei Haaretz?
Yeah.
Does that mean dumber than dirt?
No. I'll give you the answer in 1 second. I just want to get to the other side of this. But Rava says it's the other way around, that if you say this in the presence of unlearned people, that will spur them to learn more. So right away, there's a mini dispute where we don't have an answer to it. So Am Haaretz literally means person of the land, and it really means what we would say in English as peasant.
Yeah.
It really referred to the fact that most people were occupied in growing food.
Yeah, right.
I read this essay that I think over 90% of the population at the time were farmers. And it was a struggle to grow enough food just to live. So they didn't have the luxury of sitting down and learning, not to mention the teachers and the books and the pens and the parchment and all of that. Okay. So let's go on. Ben Dama, son of Rabbi Yishmael's sister, asked Rabbi Yishmael, in the case of one such as I, who has learned the entire Torah, what is the halakha with regard to studying Greek wisdom? So Greek wisdom really means secular, it means everything that's not Torah. It means all sciences and philosophy, which the rabbis were very not happy about. Rabbi Yishmael recited this verse to him, "The Torah scroll shall not depart from your mouth, you shall contemplate it day and night." And now this is a wiseacre answer. "Go and search for an hour, that's neither day nor night, and learn Greek wisdom in it." So don't do that. However, Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani disagrees. Rabbi Yonatan says, this verse is neither an obligation nor a mitzvah, but a blessing. So what is he talking about here? He's talking about the quote from Joshua of Torah not departing from your mouth. He's saying it's not a mitzvah, it's not an obligate commandment, but rather it's a good thing. The Holy One, blessed be He, saw Joshua, observed the Torah was very precious to him, and stated, and then there's a proof text in there, God spoke to Moses, and Joshua was hanging out. So the Holy One said to Joshua, "Joshua, are the words of Torah so precious to you? I bless you that this Torah shall not depart from your mouth." In other words, because he was hanging around listening to this, that's why, that he didn't want to lose it. And finally, we have a last third point of view. The Tana of the school of Rabbi Yishmael teaches, the words of Torah should not be considered as an obligation upon you, but at the same time, you are not permitted to exempt yourself from it. So now what he is... Oh, I want to go back one step. This piece about Joshua in the tent. The Talmud is hyperlinking, as it does, on the words depart. So the word depart is yamush. And that word only occurs 20 times in the entire Tanakh. One is in the story of Joshua, the other is in the story of Exodus. And by this quote, the rabbis are linking those two stories together. That's where it comes from. So, back to this last piece about Rabbi Yishmael, where he's kind of saying again that it's not a commandment to learn Torah, it's not an obligation, a chiyuv, but at the same time, you can't exempt yourself from it. So it's somewhere hovering in between. Okay, so, summarize all of this. If you approach Torah as a regulatory burden, the thou shalt's and thou shalt not's, you will most likely look to the easiest way to discharge your obligation. One chapter in the morning, one chapter in the evening. On the other extreme, you're so occupied by living with God, you have no time for anything else, like Greek wisdom. So there are two intermediate verses suggesting an alternative, that this is a false dichotomy. Torah is not a burden, but neither is it purely voluntary. The debate is unresolved. However, the structure presents the first two extremes, followed by the golden mean, which is how it ends. Another clue in the text, Rabbi Shmuel is an Amora, Rabbi Ishmael is a Tana. A Tana wins the debate most of the time. Finally, Talmud is teaching as it legislates, so the message is that the Torah study is the center of our religious experience. So once again, we've gone from this kind of surface-level showbread discussion into this whole discussion about being in the presence of God. Okay, last example, and this is one we've actually covered before, but we are going to do it now again. So, as I said, it's the advanced class, you know the background, right? We know it is a violation of Shabbat to carry from one domain to another, or to carry within the public domain. So, they're asking the question about a sword, a weapon. And the Mishnah says, a man must not go out with a sword, bow, shield, lance, or spear. Go out, again, meaning carry. Go out of his house.
On Shabbat.
On Shabbat. And if he does go out, he incurs a sin offering. Okay, so that's view number one. No. Rabbi Eliezer said, they are ornaments for him. That's view number two. What does that mean? It means he's not carrying the sword, he's wearing the sword. And we talked about it's like jewelry. An ornament. So in that case, it's okay. Sages maintain they are merely shameful. That's a third point of view in this Mishnah. And they give the proof text, beating their swords into plowshares, etc., etc., etc. So everyone knows and everyone agrees carrying on Shabbat is a forbidden activity. So the debate is over a small technical detail. Really, what is a weapon? How do we look at weapons? There's three opinions. It's forbidden, it's okay if you wear it, and the third one is a kind of in between. It doesn't say yes or no, it says weapons are shameful.
Yeah, but he could be wearing it to carry because the roast beef is tough and he needs to slice it.
Well, that wouldn't be a sword. Nice.
You're too practical.
Now, the sage's opinion...
The sage's opinion is curious, right? Why do they start quoting Isaiah in this Mishnah, right? Which is a law thing.
Because they're against.
They're going from the technical rules of Shabbat to this Isaiah's description of the end of days. So, here's a question to ask: who are the sages rebutting in this example? The Tanakhama, that's the anonymous opinion, sentence one. Or Rabbi Eliezer in sentence two.
I think they're rebutting the first one. By saying that the swords were beaten into plowshares, they're saying it's not really a sword.
Well, no, I think they're rebutting the second one because they're saying they're not ornaments. We're really against any, you know, because we want, you know, vision shall not have war anymore. They don't want any weapons. So I think they're right. It's like an anti-weapon thing.
You are exactly right. Right? There, this is not about, I mean, why would you carry a sword on Shabbat? Right? It's not going to be as a defensive weapon. You're carrying it because it looks good. Men in uniforms look good. It's ceremonial. It's an image of power, of military man, of manhood. And the sages don't like this. That's what they're unhappy about. And true, a military man is an image of manhood in the present time, but what about in the long run? What about, you know, everyone going out dressed as soldiers? So now the Gemara picks up on this. Rabbi Eliezer said, on the quote, they are ornaments for him, it was taught. Said they to Rabbi Eliezer, since they are ornaments for him, why should they cease in the days of the Messiah? Because they will not be needed, he answered. As it is said, nation will not lift the sword against nation. Yet let them exist merely as ornaments, said Abaye, it may be compared to a candle as noon, at noon. So, first of all, it was taught. That means this is a baraita, which is a strong argument. And they're answering the question that Rabbi Eliezer is saying that the weapons are ornaments, but the baraita comes along and says, no, they're really just kind of disgusting things. They're not something to be proud of. And a candle at noon, of course, is a euphemism, metaphor, simile, for something utterly useless. But what else is going on here now, right? Again, back to that question of prophecy of Isaiah and the end of days. And the answer is, the rabbis are saying Shabbat is a foretaste of the days of the Messiah. And they're projecting into the future, what will life be like in the days of the Messiah? Will we have weapons? Will we need them? So that's already changing the debate. Now, they're starting to speculate on the end of history. So now we get to the second paragraph. Now, this disagrees with Shmuel, for Shmuel said, this world differs from the Messianic era only in respect to the servitude of the exiled, for it is said, for the poor shall never cease out of the land. So what's he saying here? Shmuel is saying, who would go with Rabbi Eliezer, that in the Messianic period, there will still be poverty. And because there will still be poverty, there will still be war. And because there will still be war, there will still be swords. Poverty and strife are part of the human condition. Excuse me, so is war, and the sword will still retain its ornamental function. So notice again how the discussion has gone from the technical discussion about carrying swords on Shabbat to a foretaste for Shabbat, linking Shabbat to the end of days, to now a theological speculation on what will that be like, the end of days. Further continuing, this supports Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, who said, all the prophets prophesied only for the Messianic age, but as for the world to come, no eye sees God except you, that which he will do that waits for him. So what is he saying? He's saying that what's going to come in the world to come, the afterlife, cannot be known even by prophecy. We just can't know, right? So he's going further off on this speculation binge. Some say, said they to Rabbi Eliezer, since they are ornaments for him, why should they cease in the days of the Messiah? In the days of the Messiah, too, they shall not be eliminated, he answered. This is Shmuel's view, and it disagrees with Rabbi Chiya bar Abba. So it's the same argument as the Baraita, but instead in the Baraita you will notice he says they will cease they will not be needed in the end of days, but here in this piece of text he says they will be eliminated, right? So it's two different things. You get to keep your gun, or no, the guns are all going to be gone, is what he's saying. And again, they're shifting the debate. Now they're talking about, from the Messianic age, they're talking about the perfection of human beings. Will people still want to have these weapons in those days? Abaye asked Rav Dimi, others say Rav Avya, others state Rav Joseph asked Rav Dimi, da da da. What is Rabbi Eliezer's reason for maintaining that they are ornaments? Because it is written, gird your sword upon your thigh, mighty one, your glory and your splendor. So this is going back now to Rabbi Eliezer, who's Rabbi Eliezer's reason, who's cited here. And he kind of pulls a fast one. He says, a weapon is a symbol of majesty and splendor. How do we know that? Because the verse is about God, and God is wearing a weapon. So the ideal man is a warrior, and weapons are an ornament even for God. And then we get to the last piece of text. Rav Kahana objected to Mar, son of Rav Huna, but this refers to words of the Torah. "The verse cannot depart from its plain meaning," he replied. Rav Kahana said, "By the time I was 18 years old, I had studied the whole Shas, and yet I did not know a verse cannot depart from its plain meaning until today. What does he inform us? That a man should study and subsequently understand." So, what are they talking about? The rabbis reject the idea about God being a warrior. And they say, this is really a battle of Torah. And the ideal man is a scholar who bears sharp arguments and majestic words. This line, a verse cannot depart from its plain meaning, went on to become a watchword, certainly in Rashi's time in the Talmud, which is when you start interpreting the Torah to mean various things, you can do that, but basically the verse means what it says, is the fundamental rule of Torah commentator. So finally, to get to the end of this whole discussion, that this whole, again, small technical detail about Shabbat halacha starts a discussion of the ideal of manhood, intellectual versus physical ability, relationship of poverty to politics, the possibility of human perfection, the true end of history, theological and eschatological speculation. And that's the story.
No wonder there's so many Jewish words.